welcome back to another episode of Masked Monologues. Today, I'm excited to be joined by a writer, Kevin Flynn. Would you mind introducing yourself and tell us about who you are?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and thank you for having me on. My name is Kevin Flynn. I have a novel that has been recently released entitled Rock Creek, and it is a combination murder thriller, murder mystery, and historical thriller. And it involves a victim, a congressional staffer, who is found dead in Rock Creek Park, which is a center in the center of D.C. It's a beautiful park with a long history. And the novel focuses on the efforts of the lead detective in the case, one Shane Tinnick, to try to not only solve her murder, but also deal with demons in his personal past. You'll see if you read the book that he is a tormented character, but much of the book is centered around, and the spine of the book is focused around his efforts to solve this murder and to come to grips with a better part of himself. In terms of my personal background and what I brought to the writing of the book, I was born in D.C. I was raised in this area. I've never worked a day in my life anyplace other than in D.C. and have a deep love and affinity for the city. I was a prosecutor, violent crime and homicide prosecutor in D.C. for 35 years. And I only left my job because this book was going to be coming out. And I couldn't both serve as a full-time prosecutor and also promote the book in the way that it needs to be promoted. But I found in the course of writing the book that my trial experience substantially informed the writing of the book and aided me dramatically in terms of what I was able to do creatively with the creation of characters, with the creation of dialogue, and with creating the arc of the story. Every trial, which I did many of over the years, every trial is a story, and within that story, there are multiple, and each of those witnesses/characters has an arc of their own. That process of putting together a trial was something that I relied heavily on in writing the book. I started the book in 2007, and it went through a number of drafts before it finally reached publication. But when I look back at the first draft recently, the arc was there, the characters were there, the dialogue was a little bit too long, had to be trimmed down, and it was the same story. And it was a story that was very much, as I say, influenced by the job that I did, the people that I met, and the city that I come to know well.
That's such an interesting backstory. Can you tell us a little bit about your job when you were on trial, when you were a prosecutor?
Sure. I started out back, I was in the office. I started in 1987. And the way a prosecutor's office works is that you start out doing minor crimes. You develop the experience to handle more major crimes. And starting in about 4 years into my job, I was handling homicides. And I had almost 100 jury trials and almost 30 murder trials over the course of my career. And when someone asked me what I did for a living in a conceptual sense, I would always say that basically my job brought me into contact with both the best and the worst of human nature. The worst of human nature, obviously, were perpetrators of violent crime, many of whom, some of whom know, I got to know in different contexts and got to know them as real people. And I can get to that in a few minutes. But the best of human nature, obviously, being the victims who came forward bravely to testify against their attackers, their defendants in court face-to-face, many people who were in law enforcement, who were on the right side of the law and did their best every day to, in my phrase, achieve a rough form of justice in an imperfect world. And when I talk about the people who committed violent crimes and how it was that I came to know them, sometimes in certain cases, some of those individuals found it in their best interest to cooperate with the government and to provide testimony and information to us to prosecute others in a gang or other criminals that they were familiar with. And so more times than I can count, I sat across the table from people who had actually killed other people and had to get their entire backstory and get into, before I was going to put them on the stand in another trial, had to get into with them what they were all about and who they were and how they came to the point of doing what they did and what they were going to do to rehabilitate themselves and come to grips with what they had done and go forward in a meaningful way in society once they had served their punishment through the criminal justice system. And so all those experiences were things that they were invaluable to me in terms of writing that. When I read books, I find the books that are the least interesting are the ones that have cardboard cutout characters that the reader knows every step of the way what they're going to do and isn't surprised by anything. And I was constantly surprised in both good ways and bad by the people that I came into contact with. I was heartened by watching instances over the years of individuals who had been involved in criminality put their lives on the right track and truly rehabilitate themselves. On the other hand, I was disappointed at various times over the course of my career by the misconduct of people that were in law enforcement and whom I trusted. And so I learned over the course of many years that there's no black and white. There are shades of gray in life. And I think it's up to a novelist creating a fictional world to create characters that are multidimensional and aren't just one-dimensional. I think that's not only more enriching for the reader to read, but it's also more enriching for the writer to write.
Yes, and I'm assuming that when you saw the dark side of humanity, you have this perspective because you were right across criminals. And I'm wondering if you could see good in them and also bad in them, and if that helped you to write a dynamic character or dynamic characters in your novel, just seeing both aspects of a person, like being deceitful and coming off as righteous, as good, and then realizing that they're not on the right side of the law. What did you learn about the character of a person, and how was that conveyed in your novel?
I guess the best way to talk about this is to give a real life example. I prosecuted a gang case back in 2003-2004, and our defendants in the case were 11 members of the gang. And over the course of the run up to the trial, the prosecutorial term is flipped or turned. Seven of those gang members, they became government witnesses. They pled guilty to various offenses, and in exchange for those pleas of guilty, they agreed to be debriefed by us, in other words, interviewed by us at great length, and then to take the stand at trial. And I got to know two of the gang members very well, and I can't give their names, but one of them, actually, he was involved in a brutal baseball bat murder. There's no other way to put it. But so he came in with his lawyer, because, of course, we always talk to defendants with their lawyers present. And it became clear very early on in the course of hours of interviews we did with him that he was highly intelligent. He had come from El Salvador. He had learned English very quickly. His backstory in terms of how he got into the gang was really very innocent. He became part of a group that was not involved in criminal activity, but members of the group started beefing with other members of another group over things like girls that they were both interested in, things like that. It didn't start out as something where everybody was looking to get guns and shoot people or deal drugs in high quantities. It started out innocently. He ended up developing a drinking problem. He was about 18 or 19 or so when I talked to him. And he revealed himself not only to be very intelligent, be very thoughtful, and to be also an artist of great talent. And so he took the stand at trial. The trial went on for about 6 months. We put him on the stand 9 times because he had a part of every part of the story that we were telling. So he needed to take the stand, and he was testifying against his own family members, who were the remaining defendants, aside from the people that had cooperated. And he was brilliant. He was articulate in ways that I would never be able to be in a second language. And he took to heart what he had done. He attributed it to, and I think credibly, to his alcoholism. When he got out of jail, he got clean. He got married. And up until just about a year or so ago, when I left my job, he was still keeping in touch with me. And we would have our conversations, we probably had 5 or 6 over the years. He would call me out of the blue, and our conversations always ended the same way, with me saying to him, "You have to live for two." And he knew what that meant. He knew that was my way of saying Rojo, who was the name of the person that he had been involved in the killing of. He basically had to carry Rojo's spirit with and stay good, then carry that guilt with him, really, to some extent, to use a pejorative word, with him, and to make sure that that incident was never far out of his mind, and that it would always carry with him in terms of making sure that he never returned back to that place. And so that's only one of many examples. It's the most vivid in my mind at the moment. And on the other hand, I worked side by side with police officers, one in particular who I believed when he was testifying about a certain matter in a criminal trial, came to discover evidence that he was lying, had to dismiss the case, and then report him for disciplinary and other legal proceedings. That was a point of great disappointment. And so in Rock Creek, the people who are the suspects in Rock Creek, who are suspected in the killing of the victim, are people who are full dimensioned. And the law enforcement officers who are involved in the case they're multi-dimensional as well. They have flaws, they have imperfections, and sometimes those imperfections result in outright corruption and given the milieu of the times, 1952, outright racism.
Yes, and now I want to know, since you have such an experience, you have so much experience and an in-depth background in prosecution and these criminal trials, how did you learn about writing and writing a story, communicating in a way that connects with others? And how did you get into writing is essentially what I'm trying to ask.
Sure. I handled a case back in 2004 that involved the brutal murder of a mother and daughter. And the case went to trial in 1994 at the same time that my family was going through significant trauma in the sense that my father had been diagnosed with cancer. And in fact, during the trial, the 1994 trial, we learned that it was terminal. The family of the victims in that case were, it was a large Black family with great spiritual strength. And the book, which was called Relentless Pursuit, it came out in 2007, was all about the trial. It's sort of like the main narrative thrust was the trial. But the heart of the book, the spirit of the book, was the relationship that developed between my family and the victim's family, and the extent to which I helped them through their tragedy to the best that I could through my working with them and my work through the criminal justice system, and how their spiritual strength sustained me and my family as we were going through what we were going through with my father. I was familiar from that process. That was a nonfiction book, and I was familiar with just the act of sitting down and telling a story, putting it in print and getting it published from that experience. And I knew from my trial work, I knew how to tell a story. Every trial goes before, I don't want to generalize, but at least in DC, there are 12 jury members and by definition, they can't sit on the jury unless they know nothing about the case. So they're interviewed before becoming jurors about the extent to which they may have heard about the case through publicity, what their possible biases may be for or against the defendant or the government. So they sit in the jury box as a blank slate, so to speak. As a prosecutor, you know something about them, some basic facts, but they can't know anything about the case in the same way that a reader can't know anything about. Generally doesn't know anything about a book when they sit down, except the merest details when they sit down to read it. So I knew how to tell a story. I had to learn how to tell a story to strangers of different walks of life, many varied from mine. And I learned how to tell a story through that process, through opening statement. Every opening statement has to tell the entire, introduce the case to the jury in a way that they're going to be able to understand what's going to happen next. When you put witnesses on the stand, your questioning of them is natural dialogue. You learn how to ask a question in a way that is the most succinct and is the way that will elicit information that is the most substantively, and in closing argument, you learn how to recap a story, how to repackage it in a way that is persuasive to an audience. So all those things I had going for me when I sat down to write this novel in 2000, I started researching it in 2007, starting it, writing it in 2008. I had done a fair amount of writing on the side when I was younger, but more just non-substantial writing, I guess is the way I would put it. But I did have some writing skills. I had done a substantial amount of legal writing, but that's a completely different discipline than fiction or nonfiction writing, for that matter, nonfiction narrative writing. But I did have some things to draw on, and not the least of which was that having grown up in D.C. and wanting to write a book about D.C., I knew a lot about D.C. I still needed to research the time in which this happened, but I had a place in mind. Every story, again, every story is centered in a place. And if you think about the books that you've liked the most over time, many of them are compelling because of the place in which they happen. The Great Gatsby is a favorite of mine. The Great Gatsby, the story is shaped by where that happens, which is essentially the Hamptons in New York. Every story, every trial, there's either an inside scene or an outside scene. And I'm talking about a crime scene. And when you're putting on a trial, you need to capture an inside scene so that people on the jury are thinking, that could be my house. You need to capture an outside scene so that every juror is thinking, that could be my neighborhood. That's a way to forge an emotional connection with juries. And it's a way to, when you're writing a book, being able to capture a place is a way to convey and to get across to readers. And also, just as I've talked a lot about characters, but having done what I did, I could take the place, I could put it in a certain era, and I could populate it with characters that would be more than just superficial.
Yes, no, I completely understand where you're coming from. You went into writing. I'm so sorry. I'll cut this part out. I'm slightly sick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's fine. It's just to let you know that my voice sounds a little bit odd. But no, back to my point, I was saying that writing or storytelling was something that you did for years on end as just a part of your job. So by the time you started writing your book, you already had these skills in place. That's what you were saying, is it?
Yes, that's right. And I was really benefited by the fact that in deciding to set the book when I set it, which is 1982, that era was an era that was familiar to me. By way of just background, as the Rock Creek, I handled a case for 4 years in D.C. It involved a victim not dissimilar from the victim in Rock Creek, the novel, who was a Washington intern. She was found in Rock Creek Park, and a congressman was a suspect in her murder. I did not want to write about that case, though, from a nonfiction point of view, for various reasons, partly having to do with confidentiality of the information that I had learned about the case. So I decided, though, to just take it back 50 years and fictionalize it. So literally, Rock Creek, the novel begins 50 years to the day before the body of this Washington intern was found in Rock Creek Park. By doing so, I landed in the month of June 1950, which happens to be the same month that my parents met in D.C. under very serendipitous. And so I had a sort of an information base, both not only substantively, but also emotionally from. And had pictures from the era of them and the people that were friends of theirs and family members. And so my research was detailed, but it was inspired by and driven by a love for and affection for that time that I already had going into the endeavor, but also with eyes wide open, because as my research led me to the unavoidable conclusion that time was in some ways that you might say a simpler time, but it was also a time where it was the law enforcement was outright racist. The city was very racially divided. And the inspiration for the title Rock Creek is from the park, Rock Creek Park. And if you're not familiar with DC, it is a beautiful park. It is untamed. It's wild. It's green. It's bigger than Central Park in New York City. It stretches from not too far north of the White House all the way into Maryland, south north. And it is just, it's a great place for picnicking, for biking, for hiking, for doing all sorts of things. If you're in the park, if you're 5 minutes into the park, it's as if you are miles away from any city. But it was also, it had two aspects of it that were more ominous in terms of the era in which Rock Creek takes place. One is that it was a dividing line between the white and black parts of D.C., such that in 1950 or 51, 52 in D.C., if you were black and you strayed west of the park, which was the white-dominated area, you could be arrested just for merely going from one side of the park to the other. And the other thing about Rock Creek Park was that it has been, over the years, a dumping ground for various murder victims, predominantly victims. So when I was when I put myself into that era and I was doing research about the park and about everything that was going on, it seemed like this was a place that was really rife with thematic possibilities. And so I just went with it from there.
Yes. So now I'd like to know about starting your book. So I know once you start a book, it's a long process because maybe you're already 10 pages in and then you realize, how am I going to write 200 more pages, or how am I going to finish this book that I started? So I want to know, once you start writing your book, or once you started writing your book, how did you persevere and get yourself to the end of the book? Did you have a calendar set up? Did you have an accountability partner, or how did the writing process go for you?
That's a great question. I have to put myself back in some 16 years to when I actually started writing it. My circumstances were a little bit unusual. In the sense that I was on family leave, and my wife had been part-time, I'd been full-time. We met in the U.S. Attorney's office. We were both prosecutors, and then she moved on to another part of the Department of Justice. But she was part-time for most of our kids' childhood. I was full-time. Then we switched, and then I went actually full-on off for my job for 3 years. So, but in 2007, 2008, my routine was get up in the morning, do what my wife had been doing for years before, which was get the kids ready for school, and then pick them up at the end of the day, which meant I had a six-hour block between 9 and 3 to fill. And so that's why I wasn't working at my job. And I found over the year, I don't think it would be possible for me to have created the first draft of a novel doing what I did and working the hours that I worked. but I had this 6 hour block A, and I can't remember what exactly what I was looking to strive for in terms of word count per day, but I know that it was regimented, but it was actually knowing that I had a very discrete amount of time to fill, and I had to fill it. It really put time pressure on me in a really good way every day. The way that I started the creative process with the book was I fleshed out characters first, put together profiles of every character, at least all the significant ones, mapped out about six scenes. And my goal in every scene was to have every character, the first have the scene occur in a place that I could vividly describe. And second, have every character have an arc throughout the course of the chapter. Something, either the character changes or something about the character is revealed. And over the course of time, the character becomes more fully developed. So that was my aim. I structured the first outline pretty rigorously, and then took a step back, more or less outlined four or five chapters at a time. There is an interesting theory about how you write a novel. The theory that constructing a novel, the metaphor or similarity, the professions that are likened to in the writing a novel are either you're an architect or you're a gardener. There are architects among novelists and there are gardeners. An architect has to have a plan for everything that has to do with the building of a building. You can't change course in midstream and decide that you're going to take a building that was supposed to be 36 stories and make it a building that's 48 stories. And then on the other hand, there's the similarity. There are people who work like gardeners. They have a plan. They put plants in the garden by, say, landscapers. But then some plants are going to die. Some plants are going to flourish. Some plants are going to take over other plants. My style here was to be an architect at the beginning, but more of a gardener as I went on. Characters change on you. They go off. The more that you're with them, the more you know about them, and the more you're educated about them, and the more that you would be hurting the story if you just stuck to the plan you had at the very beginning. And so I didn't know even halfway through Rock Creek who the killer was ultimately going to be. I only developed that about halfway through because I had set up a cast of potential suspects and potential suspects. And I just decided that I was going to take the story. I was going to end up letting the story take me where it had a mind to take itself. And so that was the organizational structure and how I went about it. Starting off with the structure, but letting the story take over, but at the same time, within an ongoing set of boundaries, because I wasn't just going to let them, I wasn't going to write half of the book and then let the characters take off on their own. There still needed to be structure going forward in terms of place and potential dialogue and conflict and twists and turns and things like that.
No, I believe I would approach it the same way, because I tend to be someone who's more analytical as well. And just having that structure in place is like something you can fall back on, but then also having that flexibility where you can build on the character and let the character tell you where the story is going to go and be guided by that. So I love how you shared those two perspectives and how different writers approach writing differently.
Yeah, there's actually a very interesting story I just wrote about on my Substack. The things that you learn when you're in trial about how there are certain things that can't be planned out. There are certain things that just happen spontaneously in a courtroom. If you have a rote set of questions that you are sticking to with a particular witness, and you are not going to deviate from those, no matter what signals you're getting from the witness, what signals you're getting from the jury, because by the way, the jurors are sitting there. They're a 12-headed entity, and they are sending off signals constantly about what they think about a witness, what they think about your case. When you're trying a case, you're constantly having one eye on the jurors for their body language and whatever. But in the case I'm about to talk about, it was a situation where a moment arose, and it was a moment of spontaneity. And if I had basically just stuck to the script, so to speak, it would never have happened. It was the witness was a woman whose house, it was actually a family house, was broken into by two men who were looking for drug money. Unfortunately, this witness's brother was a marijuana dealer and had cash on hand and also other drugs on hand. She had nothing to do with all of that, but she was in the house when these two defendants came in, shot the house up, killed her brother, and left with proceeds. And she started to tell the story. I'd gotten to know her well. She was very smart. She was very appealing, very emotional. But and we had prepped her before. We'd had extensive interviews with her. But I got the sense as I was talking with her and maintaining eye contact with her that she had a story, a part of the story that she hadn't told me before. But she, in trial on the stand, was putting herself back into the situation. Just on the spur of the moment, I said to her, do you want to come into the well of the court? In other words, the part that's in between where the judge is and the lawyers are and the defendants are. You want to come into this open space and show us what happened? And she proceeded to come in and into the well, and she was talking, and then she just spontaneously put herself into a fetal position. And she was saying from the floor, this is how I got. And I needed to let her have that space and let her have that moment, and worked very well. I don't say that just strategically. I worked well for her because it got something out that she wanted to get out. And in the same way, if you're writing a chapter and a character seems to want to go in a certain direction and it's true to the story and it's authentic to the narrative, you sometimes have to metaphorically let a character curl up in a fetal position on a floor.
Yes, no, that's a wonderful piece of advice for all writers out there, is that you can have those guidelines, you can have this rigidity and the structure within your novel, but in the end, if you're opening up this other door or wants to travel on this other path, and that's true, and as you said, authentic to the story, you should go with that, and that should be your first choice. I want to thank you so much for joining me here today and telling me all these fascinating stories. Where can people find you or connect with you? Do you have social media channels, a website, and where can they buy your book?
Sure. Rock Creek by Kevin Flynn is available on Amazon. It's available on Barnes & Noble and most other retail sites, Amazon being the easiest to access. It's also, it has a Goodreads page, so any audience member of yours who is so inclined, that should, once they've read it, to post a review on Goodreads. I think there's also going to be, there's been one Goodreads giveaway we've already conducted. I think there's going to be another one that's going to be coming up in July. And finally, I can be reached through my website, which is kevinflynnauthor.com. And there's a lot of information about my background, about my two books. And also, there's a way to contact me if any of your audience members are so inclined. I welcome any contact that I can have with, if I can be so grand as to put it, my readership. So thank you very much.
No, thank you for taking the time and joining us here today. I want to say that if my listeners like this podcast episode, then please do go give Kevin Flynn some love. And if you like this episode, you want more episodes like this, then please leave a review and share with a friend or family member. And thank you so much. Loving for me, loving for me, no loving for me, always love.